20 years ago, we were involved in an African penguin rescue operation. Now, it was the biggest ecological disaster for coastal birds, and it happened right here on our shores, just at the southernmost point of the Atlantic Ocean. And it was an absolute disaster, just about wiped out the African penguin population. Now, there are 18 different species of penguins, and the African penguin's just one of them. Now, to give you a bit of a contrast, the emperor penguin is a full meter high. An African penguin's a foot high. An emperor penguin's 30 to 35 kilograms. An African penguin's about 3 kilograms. So, you know, when you see African penguins, just understand that they're not as big as the king penguins that you would get, for example, at Prince Edward Island and so on, and not like the Antarctic emperor penguins. But these are the only African penguins. Now, just to give you a bit of a contrast, the emperor penguin in Antarctica, they can swim like all penguins, like porpoises, literally jumping out of the water, because they can go through air quicker than they can go through water, obviously. So it's one of the ways of speeding up. They can go down and come up at such a speed that despite them not having real hands and legs like we do, and they can leap a meter or more out of the water and land with their feet on an ice shelf, for example, in Antarctica. That's one of their abilities. Extremely affectionate parents. Like many birds, they mate for life and they're inflexibly loyal to their mate. And it comes to pass that when the chicks are laid or the eggs are laid, the mothers all trek off and dad's left being the babysitter. And while the moms are frolicking and fishing and so on in the ocean, the fathers have the egg resting on their paws, and it must be on their webbed feet, because if they touch the ice tundra, they are dead. And so they've got to keep them on their feet, and they've got to walk very carefully, keeping them under fold of their fur skin to keep them warm. And Arctic winters are severe, extremely severe. And this is the time that the eggs need to be prepared and protected for hatching. And obviously, they have to be close in because of the ice shelf coming and going in terms of winter and summer. And so in the dead of winter, facing minus 35, minus 40 degrees Celsius degrees, these fathers huddle together and they take turns, who's on the outside, who's on the inside, to warm up and so on. And the chicks are born onto their feet, and the fathers have been so disciplined that for months they've kept some food undigested. Now, they haven't eaten in months because they can't go and fish. And they're keeping some of that food to be able to give from their mouth to the of chick, or the chick would not survive. Now, how's that for discipline? They have got nurseries where the different of the fathers will take turns protecting the chicks in these nurseries. And when skua birds come in at the beginning of spring, they might be after the chicks, they will stand guard like a lager and protect their chicks. And as the chicks are growing, of course, the mothers are on their way back from their fishing expedition, and then they take turns. Now the fathers can head off, and the mother stays and looks after the chick while the father heads off on the long march. Now, you might have seen the film March of the Penguins, which dramatizes a lot of this. Well, it doesn't dramatize, it documents it. It's real, it's not acted. Now, these penguins are so successful that there's millions of penguins. I think it's something like 28 million emperor penguins, which goes to show they're not just pro-life, they probably deserve a Father of the Year award. Or decade. But today we're talking about the African penguins. And the African penguins are a feisty little bunch. Some of us might have swum with them at Boulder's Beach in False Bay. And that's one of the only urban colonies we know of penguins in the world. They just came ashore one day in 1981 or so and just started a colony there, just like that. And they just moved in, and before people knew it, they were taking over this huge section of the beach, and now it's been declared a national park, but this didn't exist before 1981. This was a recent phenomenon. The penguins just moved in, they took over this beach, and the people in the neighborhood love it, and Mr. and Mrs. Penguin. So 20 years ago, we faced a great threat, the greatest threat that these penguins have ever faced. So this year, 23rd of June 2020, will mark the 20th anniversary of the launch of the largest penguin rescue operation in history. And I've heard some people say it's the largest animal rescue in history. Well, I don't know about that. I don't want to compete with Noah's Ark or Operation Noah in Rhodesia, where they rescued vast amounts of animals from the Kariba Dam. But certainly it's the greatest penguin rescue operation ever. On the 23rd of June 2000, the Chinese bulk ore carrier MV Treasure sank off the coast of South Africa in Table Bay between Dusson Island and Robben Island, which together support the largest colonies of African penguins in the world. Between them, 40,000 penguins on those two islands. And this happened June 2000 during not only the chick season, when a whole lot were not waterproofed and so on, they still only have fluffy feathers, but it was the best breeding season in recorded memory for them. And so this was particularly catastrophic timing. MV Treasure spilled over 1,300 tons of bunker oil, which oiled thousands of penguins on and around Robben Island and threatened to pollute Dusson Island too, which was just a bit further to take longer for the oil to drift there. 6 years before the oil spill from MV Treasure, we had faced what was up till then the worst oil spill off the shores of the Cape, endangering penguins with the sink of the MV Apollo C in a storm in June 1994. Now, that was quite a storm in 94, and trees were down and all sorts of things. And then oil started just coming ashore, and people were speculating, is this that the storm has disrupted some old ship that had sunk and some oil's... Because nobody knew. The MV Treasure had radioed back to China, in distress, ship sinking, this and the other. They didn't bother telling the NSRI, informing South Africa, so nobody went out to rescue anyone, and I believe everyone drowned. But we weren't even formed to prepare, not forget about saving them, we weren't even prepared for the oil slick, because there was no warning. China knew about it, and China did nothing, and they didn't even inform us. China's got to be the greatest ecological threat on the planet in terms of overfishing, pollution, and everything else. Well, almost 10,000 African penguins were oiled from the sink of MV Apollo C, all on Dusson Island. This was very close to Dusson Island that the ship went down. And suddenly Dusson Island is being inundated with this hideous oil. So like many other Cape Townians, I recruited all the friends I could and mobilized staff from our mission office in Rondebosch to head over to SANCOB, the Southern African Foundation for Conservation of Coastal Birds. And we volunteered and we helped with the cleaning and the feeding of oiled penguins as best we could. In the middle there you'll see who was then my secretary, now up in Zambia. You've been there, Grant's wife. And this is Tanya, who's now in New Zealand. She's also a marine biologist type. Just some of our people that came through to help out there. Many of these poor penguins were clearly emaciated, dangerously underweight, and the oil was life-threatening on many levels. It polluted their food. It polluted their water, necessary for their nutrition and also their hydration. If they imbibed any oil, it was poison to the system. It could result in kidney failure, ulcers, all sorts of problems. You can imagine it gets in your eyes, in your mouth, system. Not to mention the fact it undermined their natural waterproofing, brought on a risk of being waterlogged, resulting in hypothermia. Now, you know penguins are birds. They can't fly, but boy, can they swim well. But they've got a sort of Velcro interlocking system of feathers, which enables them to be totally waterproofed, which also comes from glands that they secrete, that they're able to be nice with natural body oils, keep themselves sleek and waterproof. But this oil gets through, unhinges the Velcro, allows them to become waterlogged, sort of on the down feathers underneath so much, so that not only could they drown, but of course they could die of hypothermia. These oiled birds all had to be cleaned. Now, this is a bird here. This isn't a penguin. This is cormorant, is it? No. Many needed medicines. They all needed food. Some of these hadn't had food in days. The SANCOB facilities in Table View were overflowing and struggling to cope with the influx of so many thousands of these precious seabirds, many of whom looked in a pitiful state, covered in life-threatening oil. And you just could not believe the damage done by this cursed oil. At that stage, 1994, I'd never before handled penguins. Like many others, I was quite surprised what feisty little creatures they are. I hadn't been aware how strong their flippers were. And while they're birds, they have a bit of a characteristic of cats in that they've got a mind of their own and they're uncooperative. And while they don't have claws, they do have some sharp beaks. We soon learned to respect these little birds who, swimming as they do among sharks, seals, and whales, do not evidence any fear of people. They had their self-respect. And they complained audibly at being manhandled. They took bites at us with their sharp beaks. And we had little training, we had little orientation, just such a rush, and there was no protective gear to speak of. Our first task was to clean the oiled penguins. To achieve this, we had buckets, sunlight, liquid detergent, and brushes to help us scrub off the oil. In many cases, we're using toothbrushes to get to some of the place, especially on the head. And after a while, we worked out a pattern. One of us would clean a penguin. Now, later we realized one is not enough. You need two people to clean a penguin. But in 94, we didn't know that. Another would rinse them in a separate bucket. And you'd have to do several rinsings because this oil is terrible. You had to make sure all the oil was off or to cause problems down the line. There was nowhere near enough buckets. There weren't enough volunteers. Far less access to hose pipes or taps. Once cleaned, our next priority was to feed these poor little birds. And it took quite some time and practice to learn how to open their beaks with one hand nice and wide by using finger and thumb just behind the jawline and the other hand to correctly position the fish for them to be able to swallow. They wanted us to force feed them. They didn't want them to become tame and they're not scavengers. They don't pick up bits of fish. If we did it wrong, the fish could be spoiled, as penguins are not scavengers. They won't pick up torn pieces of fish from the ground. They had to be hand-fed, and that's important because they're all, well, we hope they're all going to be reintroduced into the wild. So after several unsuccessful attempts to introduce medicines down the throats of penguins, very unsuccessfully, one of our people pointed out, the best way is simply place the tablets in the mouth of one of the fish and then to feed them the fish. I think that was Tanya. I mean, she's a marine biologist. Wish one of us had thought that, but good solution. It worked like a charm. You put the medicine in the mouth of this fish, close it, offer it down mouth of the penguin, solve the problem. At one point, well, at many points, but I dropped this fish on the ground, leaning forward. Everything's slippery, you can imagine. As I leaned forward, I put myself within range of this penguin, and he gave me a nice peck on the cheek. Feisty little guy. I lowered my head within range, and he took the chance. Just to remind me, he had his self-respect. He wasn't taking this manhandling passively. And considering how close to my eyes that peck was, I realized some eye protection would be a good addition to any future penguin rescue operation. I don't think any of us had eye protection. There was no such thing as goggles in 94. No thought of it. They don't have teeth, but let me tell you, those razor-sharp things on there, I don't think you can call them gums, they are very, very harsh. Now, of course, this is good for them to grab a fish, to hold it, so fish can't get away. And, of course, if they get hold of your finger and you try to pull it away, you will get lacerated. We had every hand, every finger, all over the place, lots of lacerated arms. So on. While we were very grateful to have collectively saved over 4,700 penguins who were rehabilitated, restored to good health, and released back in the wild, we lost almost as many penguins. I mean, basically, we saved half of the 10,000 penguins. Others died in the process. And due to our very inexperienced, lack of training, inadequate facilities, very limited resources, there was a great sense of having been overwhelmed, and I could not help the feeling that we should have done a lot better. Well, in June 2000, with the sinking of the MV Treasure in Table Bay, we had the challenge to put into practice all that we'd learned back in 1994 with the MV Apollo C oil spill, which was actually frustrating. I mean, to only save half of the birds that you rescued is a very shocking statistic. Now, just to say, at this moment, as 20,000 penguins were immediately oiled on Robben Island, there were wildlife specialists, including government department heads, saying that all the birds should be euthanized, should be oiled, because there's no chance of them being rehabilitated. I mean, that was the kind of mentality. And I should also add, this disaster happened in slow motion. You could see it coming for almost 2 weeks beforehand. MV Treasures developing this massive hold in the side. It's a 18-meter wide metal fatigue hole in the hull. How do you get 18-meter wide hull? This is, China doesn't care about the ships. They don't care about people. They don't care about the oceans. They're an ecological disaster area. And there were a lot of people saying, don't let it come within our coastal waters. And it was out in the Atlantic. No, they've got to bring it down here. And they want to bring it to the Table Bay. And a lot of experts saying, it's too big. It'll never fit in the harbor, which it didn't, of course. And there was, we need to siphon off the oil. Well, who's going to pay for transferring oil? And of course, China couldn't care. And the company couldn't care. And this government couldn't care. And this whole thing happened in slow motion. At one point, somebody was intelligently saying, why don't we send a helicopter, take the crew off and get the South African Navy to go out and use them as target practice and incinerate the oil before it becomes an ecological disaster, burn it up and so on. Well, nothing was done. They just they brought this ship in Table Bay. So like many thousands of other Cape Townians, I and my daughters and numbers of our staff headed off to Sandcob to volunteer our time to rescue and rehabilitate a much larger number of penguins oiled and endangered in this latest sea disaster. So the MV Treasure, although Panamanian registered, was owned by the Chinese shipping company Universal Pearls, apparently the same company that owned MV Apollo C, which had caused such environmental damage back in 1994. So reportedly, they had an 18-meter wide hole in its hull due to metal fatigue. The authorities wanted to tow the ship to Cape Town for repair, and they ignored all the experts who said, it's too large for the maneuver, it'll never fit into Table Bay Harbour, and it didn't. The oil that was spilled from MV Treasure was of the heaviest, most vicious commercial fuels that can be obtained from petroleum. Bunker oil, also known as fuel oil, is what remains of the lighter fractions, gasoline, kerosene, diesel, are removed by distillation. The hideous materials in crude petroleum are not distilled, as the boiling point is too high to be conveniently recovered. And as a result, bunker oil is very dark in color, far denser, significantly more serious contaminant than any other less dense oils. MV Treasure's bunker oil spill was described at the time as the worst environmental disaster in South Africa's history. I can't think of any close second for that. Particularly as it seriously threatened African penguin breeding grounds, Robben Island, which it was right next to, and Dusson Island, which was not that far away and the oil would reach in time. At that time, the Robben Island Nature Reserve was home to 14,000 African penguins and 6,000 African penguin chicks had just been born, the best breeding season in recorded history. And they're all threatened, 20,000 in total. Divers confirmed the ship had suffered structural damage and the oil was rising from cracks in the hull. The engine room vents leaked a steady stream of oil. These were closed off by the divers and this drastically reduced the amount of oil polluting the surface. The dive team continued to seal off oil leaks from the wreck. Within 3 days of the sinking, the dive team had sealed off all leaks from the ship. But 1,300 tons of bunker oil had already gone out. The cleanup included workers loading kelp covered in oil into trucks, vacuuming up pools of oil with specially designed vacuums. Booms were used to keep oil from entering Cape Town Harbour. And the South African company Biomatrix was contracted to help clean up the oil slick, which was polluting the penguins' habitat. This product soaks up oil, encapsulates oil without absorbing water. It's very effective in breaking down oil and digesting oil. Well, with the many lessons learned since 1994 Apollo C disaster and penguin rescue, the Southern African Foundation for the Conservation of Coastal Birds, SANCOB, worked together with an international team. Apparently, the day it happened, they were phoning friends all over the world, we need help. And so from New Zealand, Canada, all over the world, they poured in. International Fund for Animal Welfare, World Wildlife Fund, and others to rescue and rehabilitate the endangered birds. 40,000 African penguins were endangered. 20,000 were already oiled. By the time we got them, another 20,000, the oil hadn't reached them yet. And there were the chicks. Big, massive season of chicks who were completely without waterproofing and most vulnerable. Within 10 days of the MV Treasure spill, over 20,000 oiled African penguins had been admitted into the rehabilitation center in Observatory. I mean, can you see how many pools we've got here? This is a colossal operation. A massive warehouse in Observatory filled with portable pools Here we, volunteers, were mobilized to clean and feed the oiled birds. The huge railway warehouse secured to use as the rehabilitation centre covered 5 acres of covered space. An additional 6 acres outside was used for pens and pools to house the birds once they'd been cleaned, to enable them to build up the natural waterproofing before being released back in the wild, which could take several weeks. More than 3,000 orphaned chicks were collected for artificial rearing. When we say orphaned, well, it doesn't mean the parents have died, but they've been separated from their parents and need to be looked after. And there are people whose homes in Newlands and Rondebosch and so on brought in a whole lot of chicks and they were in their homes and they were being adopted all over because you couldn't accommodate thousands of birds at Sandkop, just not possible. And there's some very dedicated foster parents. There were also a number of cormorants, seagulls, and other shorebirds who were rescued, but far less of them were impacted than the penguins. 400 tons of fish were fed to the birds during this operation. Some days as much as 10 tons were fed to the fish in a single day. 7,000 tons of beach sand were brought in for the bird pens, and 7,600 litres of detergent were used. I mean, you can just imagine the expense, the effort, the amount of logistics involved in this. Well, during the oil spill crisis, my sister-in-law, Deborah, arrived from Salzburg, Austria, on her first visit to South Africa. As I was the one designated to pick her up from the airport, I explained, "Debbie, we have a crisis. We need to go and rescue penguins." No hesitation from her side, you know, welcome to Africa. Professor Deborah Peltzman was dressed in yellow oilskins, scrubbing penguins, and an effective part of the international team volunteers in the railway warehouse and observatory. Still struggling to find the picture to scan of her. But this year's her next to her younger sister, Lenora. My sister-in-law recalled, asked her for a recollection. She wrote, "I specifically remember how well organized the feeding was. Each volunteer group, mostly three people, was in a pen with three smaller pens to the left and the right. One of the smaller pens housed approximately 20 hungry penguins. We had to pick a penguin up in a correct manner, keeping your chin up and your eyes out of the way of his beak, and position the animal between your legs, keeping your ankles crossed, efficiently keeping the wings pinned between your knees so that they could not be damaged," because these flippers are, or wings, are actually quite strong too. You don't want to damage him, but you don't want him to damage you either. "We had to feed each penguin 6 fish at each feeding, 3 fish with medicine, 3 without. That done, the penguin was then carefully put in the other smaller pen so one could keep track of who had been fed and who had not. Each volunteer had to keep calm, collected, and mostly quiet, giving animals a sense of security and not adding to their stress. I also remember almost every grocery store in Cape Town had a storage bin into which people could donate towels to help clean the animals. What a fabulous experience it was, not to be missed. Thank you, Peter. The downside, remember Peter's car reeking of fish." And I must admit, I can't say I noticed. I think we all smelled of fish at that time. Then there was the relocation operation. An additional 19,500 penguins who were in danger of being oiled on Dusson Island were captured before the oil had reached them. And one of the findings of our failures in the 1994 rescue was that the boxes that they were transporting were not adequate, and some penguins died because of not sufficient ventilation. And so you can see the new penguin cardboard boxes designed had lots of air holes, and it was far more efficient, and also the trucks that they transport them had to have proper ventilation. This was somehow overlooked in the chaos of 94. And that made a big difference. Well, this was actually, there were a lot of people, what are we going to do? We can't cope with these extra. We had max, and we already got 20,000 plus. There's another 20,000 at Dusson Island. How are we going to cope? And one genius came out to the idea, well, why don't we just catch them and transport them up the coast to Port Elizabeth, drop them in the ocean, and let them swim back? That'll take a minimum of 2 weeks, and by that time we should have cleaned up the beaches. Well, that was an inspired idea. I don't know that it had ever been done before in a penguin rescue, but now it's inspired people around the world that that's what you do. Because why take an unoiled penguin, keep them in captivity, and, I mean, what for? But if you put them out in another place, they've got a phenomenal homing instinct, and they find their way back. So, and they did. So they were able to feed themselves in the wild while swimming back to Cape, and this greatly relieved the logistical challenges on the cleaning up and feeding teams. Now, 3 of the penguins, named Peter, Percy, and Pamela, were fitted with transmitters to monitor their progress. And this is afterwards. I remember we were given tracking each day. And who was at top? Well, Pamela Penguin stopped for shopping on the way. Peter Penguin got back first. And you can see they live in Dasson Island. But you can see the tracking after. This is now, you can see it's September. These are September details, August, September, showing their movements. So even after the cleanup and everything, just seeing the movements, how far and wide they travel. We believe it's because of overfishing, and they've got to look and hunt to find good shoals of fish to fish. So penguins do travel quite a bit. They found some of these who've had trackers on have gone up to Tristan and St. Helena Island and over to South America and back. So some of these penguins travel far. Anyway, it was very interesting strategy of catch, release, and let them look after themselves on the way back. The rehabilitation operation lasted for 3 months. It was the largest penguin rescue operation in history. There were 130 international team members who were normally specialists who gave the training and oversaw everything, and they supervised officially 45,000 volunteers, almost all Capetonians. The success of the Great Penguin Rescue of June to September 2000 was due to a lot of factors. The lessons learned since 1994, the large number of volunteers, a lot of volunteers, including international experts in seabird rescue, the improved transport for the penguins, the rapid arrival at rescue centers of those trained and capable of administering emergency care. And of all the penguins caught, rehabilitated, and reintroduced in the wild, the mortality rate was less than it would have been if they'd been in the wild during normal circumstances. We lost so few penguins. I mean, their life expectancy was improved by the capture instead of deteriorated, because if they'd just been in the wild untouched, more would have died from natural causes like seals, whales, sharks, or whatever. So this was a tremendous success. I think it was Cape Town's finest hour. I'd never been so proud of being Cape Townian and witnessing the massive outpouring of concern from all communities all over the Cape to help save our African penguins. And as Deborah said, shops, special bins, drives, churches, community groups to help the penguins. This was a phenomenal thing. And what it also showed is the benefit of decentralization. Central government had caused the problem. Chinese government, for start, our national government. None of them had done wrong. The mayor of Cape Town, Harbour, they'd all failed. Failed, 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 failed. Government failed on every level. National, provincial, right down to municipal. But private citizens, volunteers, went out and saved the penguins and cleaned up the beaches. And it's a phenomenal achievement. Without any government help, people from all walks of life donated time and resources in order to ensure that the penguins were rescued, cleaned, fed, and by the time they're released back to the wild, the beaches were clean, the penguins were safe. This is a Thanksgiving service we had at Boulders Beach. See the worship leader just to my right there, and one of our penguin congregations at Boulders. The day that the first batch of penguins were released back into Table Bay was one of the most joyful moments of my life. We had done it. It was such a mission impossible. And to have won. And to be honest, during that time, we all lost weight. We would hit the pillow and be out. I mean, like, and it seemed like 2 seconds later, oh, it's morning already. And, I mean, exhaustion, absolute exhaustion. You just couldn't take. With all this need, it was like rescue the perishing. Volrod Voldemort going into the water, rescuing more of the perishing, going back in again. And when you saw so much need and you're surrounded by so much need, you couldn't rest. You just had to hold yourself focused. One more. And by the way, to clean a penguin, when we did it properly, trained by them, it took 2 people about an hour per penguin to do a proper thorough. You can imagine how long an operation you're talking about. And it was like round the clock, just people working in shifts. And this are all volunteers. And as was said by one of the organizers, all of you have one thing in common. None of you had to be here. No one's paid to be here. Everyone's volunteering the time. Everyone, every last person there was there as a volunteer. And it just showed again the power of individual volunteer groups that... these people look to government. Well, government didn't solve this problem, but volunteers did. And it just showed what Cape Town can do. I mean, imagine if we could be a decentralized, independent country of our own in the Cape. SANCOB had proved to be the premier international rehabilitation center for penguins, and it coordinated the most successful operation of rescuing penguins from an oil spill disaster in history. The well-thought-through strategy of capturing, washing, and rehabilitating already oiled birds and capturing non-oiled birds as a preemptive measure and relocate them far up the coast. So we had time to rehabilitate the breeding grounds before they returned. It was inspired. You may wonder about these red patches. Well, it's water washable, water soluble. But it was to indicate that they'd been treated and so on. So the moment they start swimming, it would wash away. But there was that no penguin was to be released before they had their marking that they'd been done. It was no tattoos or branding. This is just a dye, much like for voting, except it washed off quicker. And it was also interesting. Can you see they've all got these little rings on their arms? Little rings. Now, whenever a penguin has been rescued, they put a ring on, date and so on, a tracking number. And we found that the penguins that were the most cooperative in the feeding were ones that already had rings. In other words, they were people who had already been rescued from previous operation. Now, most of the ones in 94 were from Dustin Island. But some of them must have migrated to Robben Island or something like that. But there could have also been other times. But they were most cooperative, showing penguins learn as well. And they actually didn't fight as much, and they were more cooperative, and they knew how to take the fish down from person's hand. So, interesting. Now, if they ever get caught in something else, it'll be able to be tracked, or they suddenly turn up in Port Elizabeth knowing about the migration pattern. So that's part of their tracking mechanism now. Anyone who's been rescued has got this little armband. It was practical, and it worked.
They all made a dash for the sea.
They certainly did, away from these people who've been imprisoning them for all this time.
Yeah.
The achievement of SANCOB and IFAW and World Wildlife Fund and many thousands of volunteers, not only from Cape Town, but literally from across the world, was absolutely magnificent. The worst ecological disaster in South Africa's history was decisively dealt with. And the African penguins were effectively rescued, and damaged environments were speedily cleaned up before the first penguins who had been transferred up to Port Elizabeth could arrive back at their homes in Dustin Island. We look forward to the future when fossil fuels like petroleum will be replaced by cleaner, safer, more environmentally friendly forms of energy. And we look forward to far stricter regulation of the seaways to deal with those who had irresponsibly and carelessly polluted. And I'm particularly thinking of Red China, who's the worst offender in this. As we celebrate the 20th anniversary of this historic penguin rescue, congratulations to SANCOB, and well done to all those who were involved in this massive effort, and to those who continue to rescue and care for seabirds in Southern Africa. Proverbs 12 verse 10 says, "A righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel." Penguins are very affectionate creatures, but by the way, when you come close to them and they start to move their heads from one side to the other, it's not cute, it's a warning. He's sizing it up, ready to, where am I going to peck him? So, you know, when they start moving their heads from side to side, it's a warning, back off. It's like if a cat's tail twitches. And you can actually swim with penguins at Boulders Beach. Well, this time of the year, you'd probably want a wetsuit. Diane de Napoli was one of the penguin experts who flew from America to guide, and she was very knowledgeable and did a lot of the instructions and guiding and strategies that we used. And she wrote the book, The Great Penguin Rescue, which is tremendous inspiration. 40,000 penguins, devastating oil spill, inspiring story of the world's largest animal rescue. She claims the world's largest animal rescue. I'm not sure of that, but certainly the largest seabird rescue ever. And there's also a book that you can get when you go to SANCOB or to the aquarium for children, Peter, Pamela, and Percy in the Big Spill. So that's a kind of imaginative way of telling the children about this horrible event. Well, we've been teaching about the Bible and animals for quite a while, and trying to encourage people to catch the mouse and go onto the Bible and Animals website to see other articles related to conservation. And we have Facebook pages like We Love God's Animals and Wonderful Wildlife. And there should be links to them also from the Frontline MissionSA.org website. Our vision is Africa for Christ, but one of the greatest resources in Africa is our wildlife. This is what brings a lot of tourism, which is also the lifeblood of many people's businesses. And we've got the opportunity to enjoy many of these places. Which brings up a critical issue of plastic pollution. This is just disgusting. And plastic pollution in the oceans is a great threat to all sea life. And the seas are our essential part of the life of the planet. Turtles have got a kind of system to prevent slippery jellyfish escaping from them, which makes it hard that if they accidentally, they think there's a jellyfish and they're getting a plastic bag that's blown in the southeast or two, see, they can't actually expel it because they've got teeth that face backwards. And this has caused the suffocation for many of them. Now, you can see plastic really starts back to 1862, but in the last few years, plastics have increased, especially disposable one-use plastics, which is the real problem. Not that there's something wrong with plastic in and of itself, but disposable one-use plastic is a major threat. And just think that discarded plastic kills 100,000 sea animals, maritime animals, every year. Sorry, that's not 100,000. That's 1 million. And overall, the tremendous amount of waste that goes out from, and we've seen when we've done beach cleanups. So you look at something like a waxed carton takes about 3 months to decompose, but a plastic grocery bag can take 10 to 20 years to decompose. A glass bottle, who knows, it might be there till the end of time. Aluminium can, minimum of 200 years. And so you can see, fishing lines can take 600 years to decompose. Don't know who worked that one out. But these blasted plastic beverage holders, which have ensnared many sea life, 400 years or so. This is the worst. So combined, they say the worst in terms of plastic that's polluting the oceans are fishing gear, like buoys and lines and nets and so on. But others are buckets, foamed polystyrene, plastic bottles, and plastic bags, and other things like that. So here's 10 pollution facts. This is just from Australia. Australians used 4 billion plastic bags last year. 4 billion with a B. And there's vast amounts of, they say, 100,000 marine mammals and 1 million seabirds die every year from ingestion or entangling in plastic litter. The single most littered item worldwide are cigarette butts. And they say there's more than 5 trillion plastic bottles afloat on the oceans right now. Absolutely disgraceful. Just United States statistics. America throws away 35 billion plastic water bottles a year. Approximately 5 billion plastic bags are used annually worldwide, and 40% of plastic use is in packaging. Plastic accounts to about 8% of the world's oil pollution. And it's absolutely destructive. This is now a breakdown of litter and pollution in the oceans. Cigarette butts, 41%. Plastic food wrappers, 9%. And plastic foam, 7%. It's hideous. They say when you get sushi or any kind of Japanese fish and so on, there are microplastic organisms throughout it. If you're eating that fish, you're almost certainly ingesting some plastic. And some countries, the pollution and litter is beyond disgusting. This is God's creation, which was beautiful and good, which has become disgusting and sordid because of human short-sightedness, carelessness, wickedness. And there's plastic in the ocean. And you can see how the littering, aided by rains and winds, means a lot of littering on land ends up in the ocean. And so showing how this just builds up, plastics in the environment, where does it come from, and everything from the cosmetics, road paint, all ends up in the ocean ultimately. They say there's a garbage patch floating in the Pacific Ocean as big as Texas, or twice the size of Texas, say. The massive garbage patch floating around in the oceans in the Pacific, sort of corralled by the winds and the waves. And so they found 9% of fish that they find have got some plastic in them. And the marine debris, it's absolutely horrific. And some of these things, they reckon like glass bottles and so on are going to be out there for who knows how long. What's the solution? Refuse plastic, like plastic straws when you don't need it. Reduce it. Reuse where possible. And recycle, of course, as much as possible. We do want to take recycling seriously, and we have taken it seriously. But you can just think of how many pieces. They talk about trillions of pieces of plastic all over, and the Pacific is the worst. And where's the pollution coming from? Mostly China. Secondly, Indonesia. Then the Philippines and Vietnam. Those are the worst of the worst. Africa's right down, Egypt, Nigeria, Bangladesh being the worst of the lowest of the worst. But China, Indonesia, the Philippines and Vietnam are, like when it comes to rhino poaching, the worst culprits. And again, who's contributing the most plastic to the ocean? Mostly China, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. Again, says the same. Interesting, there's a lot of focus on America, but they're the least of the problem. In terms of, you just look, South Africa is much worse than America in terms of the amount of plastic pollution being produced each year. But America's self-critical, so they'll often talk and you think they're the biggest contributor to plastic pollution, whereas actually China's the worst contributor to every form of pollution, from air pollution all the way through to plastic pollution. And here you can see again, they've got in red, proportion of plastic waste mismanaged. Notice South Africa's got most of our plastic waste is mismanaged. China's the vast majority. Whereas you look to Europe, there's almost no plastic waste misusage, and America's very, very little. Again, the worst culprits, China and Indonesia, Philippines and Vietnam, the worst. In Europe, they have compulsory recycling categories. You might have 9 categories of, you know, from glass, plastic, paper, and so on, all the way down. And that's compulsory for recycling. And Lenora said, 30-something years ago, they already had about 9 categories in Austria that they had to compulsorily contribute to, for example, and everything. So much so that different farmers would come for this kind of compost and that from their Bible college that they ran. This picture was taken in Cape Town from the Table View side before beach cleanup. After the beach cleanup, this much rubbish picked up by one group in one morning in Table View Beach. And that just shows you different. We've gone to Sea Point and done beach cleanups and so on too, and it's just extraordinary the amount of fast food junk there. Styrofoam packets, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried, and of course every kind of, and the amount of cigarette butts makes one sick. In the army they had a way of stopping people littering. Whatever you littered, whatever you dropped, you picked it up with your mouth, ingested it, chewed it, digested it. Cigarette butts were the most common. And, you know, it makes you think twice about littering when you've had that kind of training. And, you know, the idea is you litter, you eat it. And that is probably the only way to stop littering, to get people to really take responsibility. It should be a major crime. In Singapore, I think you get caned for littering. And, of course, there's a lot of water sports like... My wife is really into dragon boating, my daughter too. We've stood against seal bashing, seal clubbing in Namibia in particular, and the killing of dolphins for food on the table in Japan, and made a stand against cruelty to animals in different events and times. In the light of the clear teaching of Scripture concerning creation and mankind's responsibility for creation, we should treat animals with the love and the concern of those who must give an account of our conduct to God. They are God's animals. We must recognize that the welfare and protection of animals is an essential part of our Christian responsibility. We must do all that we can to secure the well-being of all animals who with ourselves inhabit the earth and so fulfill the creative joy and purposes of Almighty God.